Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Matthew Penny is back in the building. We're going to talk about the Sweet 16, the Elite Eight, a few different NBA prospects that we saw over the course of the weekend playing college basketball, some coaching hires that have occurred, and then we're going to debut a new segment at the end of the show, Recruiting Stories with Matt Penny. Penny, how you doing, man?
I'm great. I'm excited. I'm still wired from the late night games. I haven't come back down to earth, and I'm hoping to ride this out for the next, 6 days, and we're done. So I'm enjoying it while we're here.
It's just the best. So before we get into any of that, I wanted to just talk real quickly about this very interesting Russell Westbrook quote from overnight. I thought it was just totally fascinating. It seems like he's in like a back and forth with Stephen A. Smith. Because Stephen A. Smith is doing what Stephen A. does in terms of being like an entertainer that comments on basketball, which is great. Like Stephen A., like I've no beef with Stephen A. He's fucking hilarious, I think. But just like refuses to give Russell Westbrook credit, which is also absurd to me. And on Stephen A. Smith's comments, according to Fred Katz, who I assume was like just transcribing what was a Zoom call post game from the Wizards game last night, Russell Westbrook said, "I've been playing basketball for my whole life. Like my wife mentioned, it's important that you don't let people deter you from your goal, deter you from your plan, deter you from the things that you have as destiny in this world. The prime example of it is I watch these college games and I watch these kids and these announcers, man, they get on TV and say anything about a kid. They don't even know him. They don't know his family. They don't know where he's from. They don't know what he's been through. They don't know his troubles. They don't know his pain. They don't know anything about the kid. But one thing said on TV can determine how you perceive this kid, which will allow him to be able to reach his goals, which will allow him to be able to get drafted, which will allow him to take care of his family, which will allow him to create generational wealth, which now makes our people and the minorities underserved communities. This is way bigger than basketball. That's my entire life focus. My wife, that's what she's mentioning because we talk about it all the time. I sit back. I don't say much. I don't like to go back and forth with people. But one thing I won't allow to happen anymore is to let people create narratives and constantly just talking shit for no reason about me." And there's like a big paragraph like after that as well that we don't really need to go into necessarily. It's about just like Russ not caring about a championship and being a champion of life because he's made it this far. And like, that's a great mindset to have. And I have like an immense amount of respect for Russell Westbrook, because anytime that you talk to someone about Russ within basketball outside of the media, like he's very much considered like a positive figure, like off the court. And he does like a ton of crazy positive work in the community and all that stuff. Like you would kind of concur with that, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with that part. Yeah.
Yeah. Like his really made it like a goal of his to try to help the community in like a very real way. So I totally understand where Russell Westbrook's coming from here. And I find the first part of this just really fascinating because I think it informs a lot of what we do on this podcast. Like, I think that people would look at that quote and say like, "Hey, you guys are assholes for evaluating players and, you know, saying that this player isn't good enough, that player isn't good enough." I mean, what was your reaction when you first saw this quote? Like I found it to be fascinating. I wouldn't say that it was, a departure from what we do necessarily, but it certainly just kind of connects in a real way as well.
A lot of layers to it. Maybe it recalibrates a little bit. For the most part, I would say you especially are generally positive here. You're going to criticize, right? You're going to evaluate players' games, whether they're freshmen in college, maybe even earlier, some of the high school stuff, and then NBA guys. More so, I took it as he's sick of the media scrutiny, and it's I get it. When you have a microphone in your face every night, you turn on the cable TV shows and you have talking heads on there and they need ratings and clicks and eyeballs, and their show happens every single day. So you almost have to like create this content, whether it's not even there, out of nothing at times. And I think his larger point is you don't even really know me as a person. These players on TV as a person. So you shouldn't be so quick to judge and have this look at someone without really knowing their experiences and their story. And I understand that. I do. But it's also when you're playing and you're on the stage, you're opening yourself up to evaluation. That's just part of the draft process for us that we kind of do here once a week.
Yeah, totally. And I think that Russ's mindset on this is something that has informed the way that, and look, like he just said it, but like I've been talking to more and more players, been talking to more and more people within the industry over the course of the last couple of years. And this mindset that he kind of alludes within this quote actually is something that like has kind of informed the way I think about it. Like I really try to think about it from a player first mindset a lot of the time. I do think about it from a team mindset whenever I'm doing a mock draft and filling this stuff out. But like my goals with a lot of this stuff is to provide real information to players that, you know, they may or may not necessarily be getting, and also to entertain an audience, right? But I try and do it from a player perspective with the way that I create content. And I think that one part of doing that is providing real information about where players are and where they are seen by NBA evaluators, so that they are not necessarily getting poor information, right?
Yeah.
Like I mean, you know this as well as anybody. Anybody who is a top 150 prospect in college basketball going forward, you know, potentially to the NBA draft, every single one of those players has people in their ear saying, you need to go pro. Like, you need to go. It's time. Like, you got to go. And that's not always the best case for those kids. And I always try to think about it from, like, what is the best decision that those kids could make? And it's like, for instance, like, one of the reasons that I put on the bottom of my big board last time. And by the way, there will be another big board coming, I think, either tomorrow or the next day. Top 100. Why I put on the last one, like, hey, these guys are 18 really interesting guys, but they should not consider leaving right now. Like, they should not consider going pro because they're not at the peak of what their stock could be. They're not at the peak of what their potential value could be if they wait and continue to develop at an incremental or potentially astronomical pace if they were to hit like a spurt in their development, right? So, yeah, I just found Russell Westbrook's comments interesting and thought he was like dead on in a lot of ways. And I thought it was good to hear a player like him, and we're starting to get more outspoken players like him and Draymond Green talk about player development in a real substantial way. And I think that's great. Like, I want to hear as much from those guys as possible, especially guys that, like, you know, Russell Westbrook was a late bloomer in high school who, you know, was defensive player of the year at UCLA and then turned into like an offensive, dynamic, incredible player in the NBA. Draymond Green, you know, obviously his development throughout his time in the NBA is well chronicled. I would love to hear more from these guys. Like, I find the whole thing fascinating, and I don't think it's antithetical to what we do here at all.
There's two sides for sure of that. I agree with your points. These are also, when we're talking about the NBA draft, and I remember, I think it was Sagana Joe, when he was at Oak Hill Academy in the Wayback Machine here, he was going to go to college, and someone showed him the projected amount of money you get with each draft pick. I want to say it was North Carolina showed him it. They said, I can make that much if I'm drafted 10th. So part of it is you're also providing intel to NBA teams and franchises who are making multi-million dollar decisions on where these guys are drafted. And there's a difference between being critical and saying, here's the guy's strengths, here's the weaknesses, he was 4-for-20 in this game of the tournament, versus completely deflating a player's character without really knowing that background story. And NBA teams are good, and I'm trying to think of the word here, of kind of deciphering what's good information, what's bad information. They probably don't take the stuff that's on the cable news networks as seriously as someone who may be in the weeds, involved around the player, or knows the right people to talk to, so they get a more informed decision. But part of it is also being outspoken and alerting people to these issues, that kids are still kids, and as we do this and talk about 19-year-olds and college sophomores, and I didn't know what I was doing at 19. I don't know what I'm doing now. So we have to also take that in consideration when we're in our hypercritical state that we can get in at times.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, like I am The more that I do this, the more that, like, I know what I don't know in terms of, like, developmental cycles of players, right? And I always try to phrase things as, like, where he needs to get better versus...
You leave it open-ended. Not, he can't shoot. Well, if he develops his mechanics, if he tucks in his shooting elbow, if he holds his follow-through, those things, right. As opposed to completely running a guy off. Because, you know, if you get to the right developmental program in NBA, it makes a world of a difference. And then you're looking at the guy and saying, I missed that. Maybe you didn't miss it, but you didn't know the situation that they'd be in to improve down the line.
Yeah, totally. All right, let's move on to evaluating these kids that played in the NCAA tournament. Yeah. Let's just get critical.
We're trying to be good, but not now.
So Evan Mobley played Jalen Suggs, and this is a top, for me, 3 matchup of prospects in the NCAA tournament. And fascinating game for a number of different reasons. Jalen Suggs was a monster. He was so good in that game, I thought. And then on the other side, Evan Mobley was just okay, let's say. He went for 17 points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists. I thought his best skill in that game was his passing ability. I thought that that's what kind of shone through most. But like Drew Timmy kind of got him a little bit. Actually, quite a lot of it.
A lot of
it. If we're going to be real about it.
Yep.
So where do we sit on these two after this game? Like, I think that the title of this podcast could be not overreacting to the NCAA tournament, not being overreactionary to what we see.
Good luck. Good luck. Every article, whether it's newspaper, online, mock draft, we've all said, don't look at these 3 games and make rash decisions, but we're all doing it.
I know, right? Like
that's the name of the podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't make rash decisions. So yeah, give me thoughts on Mobley and Suggs.
So I'll start with Suggs. My pregame notes, I take them on my phone as I watch. The opening line after the Creighton game is, we've yet to see the Jalen Suggs game. So within like 3 minutes, I deleted that line off my phone because this was the Jalen Suggs game. 18 points, 10 rebounds, 8 assists. And he credited fellow Minnesota native Paige Beckers, who starts with UConn's women's team, for giving a pep talk and telling him to kind of turn it up and play your game. His separation speed with the head of steam playing downhill is ridiculous with his handle. And when he gets in that like one-on-one situation, it's impossible to stop him by a guard in isolation coverage. And that's the difference to me. And the feel he had, that bounce pass on the break, throwing the needle to Nembhard, you just throw your arms up in the air. I don't know what you're supposed to do to really stop that thing. For Mobley, I said this about a different play last time. I just can't figure him out. I don't know what to do because he does these absolutely tantalizing things on the court, like the Oregon game, start there. So they were switching everything, and there was a switch where Duarte gets on him, and Duarte's kind of like, crap, I don't know what I'm going to do. So a shot goes up, Duarte pushes him in the back, he tries to get him out of position, Mobley catches and dunks, like a snap of fingers how quick it was. Then he goes on these long runs of 6-plus minutes where he'll protect the rim a little bit and alter some shots, but he can drift. And then he hits you with the monster poster dunk of the tournament, which the picture looks fake. It looks like a cutout you'd find at an amusement park that you put your head in and take a picture. And like, that's not real, is it? But he doesn't call or demand for the ball enough. And then the Oregon game, he had 10 points, 8 rebounds, 6 assists. We saw that passing stuff. The passing did stand off the most. What's interesting to me is he has 79 assists to 74 turnovers this season. He's been much better. So if we want to overreact there too, the assist numbers have been better in the tournament. Against Timmy, the 17-5 felt quiet on 5-11 shooting. And Timmy scored kind of how he wanted, around him, through him, over him. And as dominating as Drew Timmy is, it's not going to get easier when he's playing bigger guys in the NBA.
Yeah, no, that's definitely right. I will say, like, you kind of mentioned the assist to turnover ratio, right? If you go back through, I would say, his last 13 games, it's very positive. It's like 1.5.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Mobley. Yeah. He's gotten way better at not turning the ball over as the season has gone on. And particularly making high level passing reads as well. Like, he's had passing games of like 7 assists, 6 assists. He had 5 assists against Kansas. Like, he's been really, really good as a passer late in the season. I mean, it's hard because, like, part of me wants to say he's being passive. Part of me wants to say he's being unselfish. And I don't really have a problem with him being passive. Like, I just wrote a whole story about, like, the fact that the reason USC is so good is because he's not passive, or because he is passive, because he is, like, unselfish. He's willing to make the right pass. Like, he is selfless in the way that he focuses his energy defensively more than on offense. But if you're going to take a guy in the top two, like, you do need that guy to be able to consistently create a shot, and he's not quite there yet at being able to do that.
No, he has to be able to get his, and that Creighton game with Suggs, he only had one shot the first 11 minutes, and he was pushing the tempo and making the right reads in transition, but then he calls his own number, and he gets a bucket. Like, that's the difference to me. Like, you can drift, you can pass out, and the interior passing for Evan Mobley is really good. He had a couple of nice high-low passes. He kicked opposite to shooters. But there's going to come a time when the clock is winding down in a playoff series, and, like, we need two. We're throwing the ball to you. Get us 2 points. And there's times that he can do that, and others you just don't know. His shot looks better. He's really good on the short roll, but you want him to even be a little bit more confident in that, and you catch a short roll, just catch and shoot. Like, he can pause just for a slight millisecond, you can tell, and then pulls up. Just a little bit more belief, and you saw his face on that dunk for Eugene Omorui on him. It's like, I want to see that all the time. And you do that all the time. We're talking about him number one. It's hard for me to put him in that tier when you see what happens with Jalen Suggs when he turns it on and has weapons around him at his disposal, which will be similar athletically in the NBA.
Yeah, and with Mobley too, like, it's, I mean, like, what do we think the ceiling is? Like, if he would be a consistent 20 points, 11 rebounds, I mean, you and I both think he's, like, potential defensive player of the year, right? Like, that's kind of where we're at.
For Mobley?
Yeah.
If the weight gets there, yes. Like, the defensive player of the year stuff's great, and I was talking to somebody today about it, and the narrative a little bit was, well, what's Drew Timmy going to do with Evan Mobley? It should have been like, what's Evan Mobley going to do with Drew Timmy? That turned me off, and Timmy has a bag of tricks, but I didn't leave there saying, wow, that he was not able to do what he wanted. He scored any way he wanted yesterday.
To an extent, yeah. I mean, beyond to an extent, like, he did. Yeah, he scored in any way that he wanted. Like, I will say, like, Timmy got a lot of what he was doing out in transition and shot 10 of 19. Like, it's not like he was, like, wildly efficient yesterday.
No, but the first three or four possessions set the tone where he caught it and was like, ooh, is this going to be blocked, punched into the third row? He went through him, that he scored the right hook, then hit another one on the other shoulder, comes down and hits one from the elbow, kind of does the flex, the mustache dance, and then Suggs come down and get a basket, and they keep coming at you too, which doesn't help when they're scoring from every place on the floor.
But what, like, probably, I mean, he probably had 8 points out in transition yesterday, right? Something like that.
So give him 50. I don't have your analysis, your heat chart, your shot chart, but if he had 8 in transition, he still had 15 in the, say, free throw line and in, because he's not shooting threes.
But he probably had, like, 15 on, like, 13 shots, right? Which is pretty good against Drew Timmy, right? So, like, I'm not saying Evan Mobley was, like, good yesterday. Like, he wasn't. But I thought a bigger problem for USC was they kept turning the ball over, especially early in that game. Really just early. Like, the second half was not really a game, right? We can just say that. Like, I think it was tied in total in the second half.
I was going to say tied when, yeah.
Yeah, like, I think the second half, like, ended up being like 35-35 or some shit like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I think that early in the game, USC's turnovers just set the tempo, and it was very easy for Gonzaga to just run out and get buckets and score way too easily. And once it settled a little bit, and it's hard because, like, this game wasn't competitive, but, like, I didn't think Gonzaga was, like, amazing offensively in the half court. They were good. But it's not like they were, like, ridiculous either.
No, but you take your foot off the gas and you're up by 20, get a little bit more ball movement. They had 21 assists to 9 turnovers. Toward the end, you're playing different players, and they went to the embarrassment of riches line, we'll call it, that you outlined in a tweet, which you just look and say, how are these 5 guys not playing and on the bench? But even before that...
Oh, by the way, the funnier one is that, so their garbage time was Martinez Arlauskas, what, like, top 4 international recruit in 2019, right? Umar Ballo, who was probably the top international recruit in 2019, right?
Top 3 at the least, yep.
Yeah. Dominic Harris, top 75 recruit. Julian Strother, top 75 recruit. Ben Gregg, top 100 recruit. Pavel Zakharov was like a top, what, 60? Something like that,
yeah,
recruit?
Yeah, big time.
In 2019 and like can't even get into their garbage time lineup.
I mean, that's a tournament team, honestly. Like, that's a tournament team.
Yes.
They're playing somewhere. That might be like a 12, a 10 seed, but they're in the tournament.
That team probably wins the WCC.
maybe. They're competing. They're in the conversation. That's a clickbaity headline. Is this the real championship team? Once people run out of stuff to write about in the next 3 days, maybe we see that.
That team, I think, legit wins the WCC. If Mark Few is coaching that team, it wins the WCC.
Mark Few is coaching that team. They're undefeated and playing for the Final Four.
It's fucking unbelievable.
I also, now you have this critical bug in my head, like, don't be a hater, don't be a hater, don't be a hater. I still really like Evan Mobley. I do. But it's hard for me to get around with the good wings, point guards, people in front of you, like a Jalen Suggs and Jalen Green we'll talk about later, but we're underselling that he averaged 18 points per game in a G League Ignite versus borderline NBA guys. Those guys are in the conversation. Even Kuminga, if his jump shot can figure out, it's not a draft where he's a clear-cut one or two. There's a great handful of guys to pick through. It will be team-based. It's still a battle for two beyond Cade Cunningham in my world. I just it gave me a little bit of pause. I was waiting for him to, as good as he's been in the tournament without the numbers popping, and his numbers actually were better the other day than they were against Oregon, despite Oregon being a more well-rounded game. I just was left leaving more based on the flashes we saw in the Pac-12 tournament in earlier rounds.
Yeah, I don't think that's wrong. I think that's like reasonable in terms of a take. I mean, you guys will see the top 100 tomorrow. You guys have probably realized over the last few weeks, like I was talking to an NBA scout who listens to the podcast, and he was like, yeah, like I've kind of been able to tell that like you have Suggs at two probably. And yeah, that's true. Like I have Jalen Suggs.
Good read. Yeah, that's why you're a scout. Yeah.
Good read. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break and then we'll be back. Let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy Mode, you know, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where Joy Mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's G-A-M-E. T-H-E-O-R-Y. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAME Theory. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, we're back, and let's run through some of the guys that had big NCAA tournaments or questionable NCAA tournaments based off of what we saw over the course of the last couple of days, 4 days really. Let's talk about the UCLA guys first. So the guys that stood out to me are Johnny Juzang and Jaime Jaquez. I've liked Jaime Jaquez for a long time. I did not think he was really a chance to leave to go to the NBA after this year, and I still don't really think so. He will be the favorite to win the Pac-12 Player of the Year next year, though, if he goes back. I think that that's my take, even potentially ahead of Johnny Juzang.
Right,
I think that Jaime Jaquez is just like that dude for college basketball. And I think he has a real shot to play in the NBA. Where are you on Johnny Juzang and Jaime Jaquez?
I'll start with Jaime, then we can do the Johnny Juzang tour. With Jaime, he actually played on the same grassroots team as Jalen Green and was a complimentary piece, I would say. And he's hit these dagger jumpers all tournament long. 27 in a win versus Michigan State, 13 BYU, 10 against Abilene Christian, 17 in a win versus Alabama. He was bad against Michigan, and that's also part of when you're being defended by Franz Wagner, that's his job to make you look bad, and that's why you go 1-for-6. He does have that kind of NBA stylish game of face ups and isolation scores. Yep. He does the pump fake jump into you, move for fouls, and he'll make defenders pay when they gamble and they reach in. He stops hard and he'll get defenders on their heels. He doesn't look like it should work, but it really does. And like the contested step back he had in overtime versus Alabama was just like ridiculous. And like, oh, yeah. there was nothing you could do to stop that. And when you're at 6'6" and can kind of create his own shot a little bit off the side, off the dribble, it's going to be a longer look. Not a this year draft guy for me. We'll be interested if and when he goes back, what it looks like in a season.
By the way, very young for his class as well, like just turned 20 years old, I think a month ago. So very interesting in terms of the developmental trajectory that he's on. And the funny thing was, like, you go back and watch like the Jalen Green, Jaime Jaquez teams, like Jaime Jaquez was playing center on those teams. Like he was like an undersized
you were playing rebounder for Jalen Green, but yes.
Right. Like,
I mean that sincerely. Like Jalen Green was a bucket and was shooting a lot.
Right. And he was like the dirty work big. And now you see that like the work he's done in terms of skill development, his footwork is unbelievable. It is absolutely incredible. His fluidity is incredible. He is really, really good as a pull-up shooter, particularly just in terms of like, you know, going right to left, crossover, step back, and then fluid ball pickup, getting into the shot like a one motion jumper. I think he's going to be like a really fucking good shooter. Like even just like a, you know, he's hitting 39% from three this year shooter. Like I think he's going to be a really, really high level shooter at some point in his life, especially given just like the work ethic and everything that you hear. So
he's still going to take some ones like, I wouldn't say wild, but still more on the move. So without your feet set as much, the percentage could be lower despite being a better shooter. And you mentioned him playing center. You kind of can see that a little bit. And the way he'll like back down his guys and people like post cut off him from the mid post. So he's turned that out of position playing younger into somewhat of an advantage too.
Yeah. And like you watch him on defense too. He's really good on defense.
Oh yeah. All Pac-12 defense, right?
I think he was like honorable mention. You know, I've made my thoughts known on the All Pac-12.
I forgot we can't talk about Pac-12 awards here. Defense
over the years. I don't know if he should have been All Pac-12 defense, to be honest. Like he's like on the borderline of it, but he is like a legitimate plus defender. Yeah, just really good. I think he's a real NBA prospect down the road, probably for 2022, but nonetheless, like a real guy to pay attention to. Johnny Juzang, I think, is also more of a 2022 prospect, but also 6'6" and a very real shooter. Like, I know he's shooting 35 from three this year. He takes a million tough ones. Like, do not pay attention to that percentage. He's a 90% foul shooter, like, real shooter. Over his last 16 games, he's up over 18 points per game. So this is not just like an NCAA tournament run that is pushing Johnny Juzang like onto the board of draft, you know, evaluators. It's been about 2 months now, a little bit over 2 months even, since he's been a genuinely elite player in the Pac-12 for UCLA. What do we do with Johnny Juzang at this point? Like, I think my immediate reaction is to wait a year, but like, if he has a big game against Gonzaga, it's going to get real interesting real quick.
It's going to get real Malachi-y in here. I thought that it was going to work in Kentucky, because when I saw him in high school, the way he shot, and Kentucky was kind of going through those woes of needing a shooter, and then just it didn't work. We don't have to like overanalyze it. It wasn't the best fit. It's fine. He found the best fit closer to home. The NBA stuff, when he come off screens, he does do a good job of squaring to the hoop when he does shoot, but he does some wild stuff. And when he's feeling it, he'll take that extra crazy step back dribble and make a face when he hits it. And you say to yourself, well, he's going to take another one the next possession too. And you have to live with it because he's had more than 23 points three times already. And he was incredible in the Michigan game. He was 28 points, 11 of 19. It was timely baskets throughout. It was almost a 28 trillion because he had 28 points, two rebounds, and like goose eggs for assists, blocks, steals, fouls, turnovers. Which after the game, I don't really figure out the stats till afterwards, and you miss that stuff sometimes.
Right.
The 12 straight points in the first half was also a show, and he did that NBA flail of the arm sling in the second half to draw a foul. To have Hawkes and Juzang on the two wings, potentially coming back next year with the only senior on their roster is Chris Smith, who could be back because of an ACL injury. Maybe he does the bonus ball a year. They're going to be good again.
Yeah, I think this, like, Mick has this thing rolling now. I mean, this is...
It wasn't long ago that people were questioning the hire when they lost to Hofstra and Cal State Fullerton in year one. The media jumps all over him. He still goes 19-12, ties for second in the league. And, oh yeah, P.S., we're in the Final Four, and Deja Nix decided to go to the G League. Chris Smith tears his ACL, hasn't played since December 31st. And Jalen Hill's left the team for personal reasons. We've added Mac Etienne, who's at Brewster Academy in a high school to start the year. And, yeah, just to remind, we're in the Final Four.
Yeah, like, and by the way, this team lost its last four games of the season.
right.
Like, they were not hot coming in. Unbelievable. I mean, Mick Cronin is ridiculous. He's absolutely incredible. And by the way, is something on fire in your house?
No, it's not my house. I'm not in the city. This is like a longer discussion, but there's always some trucks or somebody backing up. That's all you're getting. I'm keeping you on your toes.
I love it. I needed it so much.
There's always some extra sound here for you.
Do we just want to have the Mick Cronin conversation now then? Like, Mick Cronin...
I do. Yeah. Because I'm a Mick guy.
Explain why you're a Mick guy. I'm here for it.
Because Mick Cronin is unapologetically who he is. He wants toughness. He wants guys who want to play defense. And when you talk to coaches on their staff about recruits, they don't... They obviously want the highest level talent of kid, but the question is always, can he play for Mick? Because you need to fit that mold. He'd rather have a smaller, tougher guy than somebody who's 7 feet tall that can play his style. And when he got the job, UCLA targeted crazy names of Calipari and Tony Bennett, and then I think even Jamie Dixon and Rick Barnes. So when he was hired, it was widely questioned and almost borderline criticized, I would say.
Because at
Cincinnati, he had nine straight seasons of 22-plus wins, but he hadn't been outside the round of 32 since making the Sweet 16 in 2012. You're at UCLA, you have 11 national championships. There's just this expectation level. But it's like the transfer stuff. It's patience and it's timing. And they figured out the defense thing later on in the year. They have really empowered Jaime Jaquez and Johnny Juzang. And Tiger Campbell's been really good. And despite the losses, they've played their style, which people, again, questioned, are you going to be able to do that in Westwood, where people see the bright lights in Hollywood stuff? He has. And the players that they've also added in a year with the whole returning roster, Will McClendon, who's a tough, gritty guard from Vegas, Peyton Watson, who's a late-blooming forward, McDonald's All-American, and then in 2022, they added a top-10 guy in Amari Bailey. So he's already... So much has changed in 2 weeks because they had a play-in game 2 weeks ago, and people would say, UCLA is not supposed to have a play-in game. Well, now they're in the Final Four, have it rolling in the recruiting stuff, and their whole roster coming back. So I tip my hat to what he's done. He just kind of put his head down and work, and it's been a big talking point the other way. So I'm just glad he's able to kind of enjoy this success as it's kind of unfolding.
Yeah, I'm going to be really interested to see what this roster looks like next year. Like, it wouldn't stun me if someone left because Peyton Watson's coming in. Because, like, Peyton Watson's taking someone's spot, right? Like, that's just happening.
He is. I mean, you don't want to be too much of a downer, but that could be a G League Ignite thing, too. So that's a wait and see. But if he does end up there, then for sure there's going to be playing time that he gets because he's that good.
Is that like a public thing, that like Peyton Watson G League Ignite thing?
No, I'm just saying he's a top 10 kid. He's a McDonald's All-American. Like, there's going to be those type of conversations. I'm not trying to be some hot takey breaking news here.
Yeah, this is not breaking news. This is not a thing. Do not aggregate this.
There's no aggregation, no.
This is Matthew Penny speculating.
Yes, just pure speculation.
Yes. So I'll be fascinated to see what this roster looks like. I think that Mick Cronin, by the way, this was the most Mick Cronin Cincinnati game of Mick Cronin's UCLA tenure.
Oh, yeah.
Like 51-49, gross basketball, just like fucking terrible basketball game. Like, let's be
clear. That wasn't terrible. That was good basketball. We can force a projected top 10 pick into an air ball 3-pointer. And he said post game too that.
Did he force it though? Like, he was wide open. He was wide open.
No criticism. Russell Westbrook, channel it. But he said that he was most enthused, I guess, post-game, that they didn't foul. A lot of times, end of games, it's a foul, it's a free throw, it's something away from the ball. Game ends like that. They didn't. They played a good defense and boxed out and got the rebound.
They were great on defense, but, like, I don't know. Like, I'm not really interested in watching Hunter Dickinson, like, go full Zoolander and can't turn, like, left the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, tries to do the same post move every time.
It works, for the most part.
Did it, though, against...
It did for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it worked. It worked a lot in the Big Ten. We'll say that. Worked against Ohio State in the... what was it? Was that the Big Ten title game? Or no, it was... Last game of their...
Illinois Big Ten title, yeah.
Yeah. It was not the Big Ten title game. It was the semifinals, where he had like 20 points and like crushed it. But yeah, Hunter Dickinson. And let's go to Michigan now, because that game was interesting for the Michigan guys too. I think Hunter Dickinson needs to go back. I'm just going to say that. Just not good enough defensively yet in the things that he will need to be good at the NBA level. Like, he needs to get better at sliding and being able to wall off and drop coverage, which is what he's going to have to play. He's going to have to get better at like finishing around the rim at the end of the day. Like, he needs to have more than just that one singular post move. I think he has some shooting potential as well. Like, the ball does not look bad coming off of his hand. I would like to see him work on being able to shoot the ball as well.
The shooting, for sure, and also the feet defensively, even on his drop coverage, being able to have some semblance of stopping guys on that end, because he would be exposed some in pick and roll when you're in such a pick and roll heavy league in the NBA.
Yep. Franz Wagner now. That was one of the worst games I think we've seen a potential top 10 pick play in a while. He went 1-for-10 from the field. Was not his typical defensive self. Like, he did a pretty good job on Jaime Jaquez, but like Jules Bernard kind of took him to task a little bit, and he got scored on a couple times in space, like blown by in switch scenarios or scramble scenarios where like they're in semi-transition. He couldn't cut off the ball. Look, you don't want to take away too much from one game, right? Like, Franz Wagner was really good in the previous two NCAA tournament games. He was really good against Florida State, had 13 and 15, and was really great within the flow of their offense, and was great against LSU, too. I think he had like 15 and 8 or something in that game. But man, was that a bad last impression to leave in the eyes of scouts for Franz Wagner.
Not what the last snapshot you want scouts to remember you by. There was some chatter prior to that Florida State game on how he would match up with Scottie Barnes and how he'd respond with his athleticism and length. And I actually thought he was really good. And he beat Scottie Barnes off the dribble, not enough to blow by him, but kept him on his hip. He forced the defense to react, rotate. He leads to those easy Hunter Dickinson baskets dunks. He did it for dunks twice in a row. He did miss three straight threes that game, but he bodied up well to Barnes on his drives, and he took over that primary defensive duty against MJ Walker late. MJ was 5-for-14. UCLA, not good. Well, I mean, 1-for-10 from the field. He ends the tournament shooting from three, I think 2-for-16, or maybe that was the last two games. But he was solid, I thought, on Jaime Jaquez, holding him to one field goal. He challenged and forced him to bad shots. He probably should have been on Tuesday earlier. I was listening to it, and you can kind of hear the volume on my computer screen when you log in here. I couldn't believe the last play, because I thought it was such a good play call from Juwan Howard. It was a dribble handoff to the left-hand side into a pick-and-roll with Hunter Dickinson, which just had been a dunk so many times you saw during the season. The defense miscommunicates, goes under, and he airballs a three by, like, a lot. I was surprised when it didn't hit anything, because normally those ones release, it's like, that's the dagger. There it is.
Yeah. 2 for 16 in the NCAA tournament from 3. Yeah, you hit it right the first time. Yeah. That was... Look, I've been, like, semi-questionable on France the whole way, right? Like, I don't want to say I've been, like, a downer, but I think I've been a little bit lower on him, right?
Yes, you have. You have. I've probably been higher, middle first, late lottery. You're kind of... I would guess, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're more in like that 20-ish type range. 20 going upward, not the other way.
Yeah, like I have him at like, you know, 15, 16, 17, you know, somewhere in the 20 range. Yeah, I would guess that that's probably right. Great player. Like, I really like him. I'm still trying to figure out, is he good enough defensively and is he a good enough shooter to really make like the highest level difference in the NBA? Is he like these guys that are like elite level defenders, they're better athletes than Franz Wagner in the NBA, we could say, right?
That's fair. But he hasn't not been able to get a shot off. And what he does do well, despite the shooting slump, he knows how to operate within space. He knows how to, I'm 6'9", I'm long, off one or two dribbles, I can get to the rim and do a runner, I can do a short pull-up, I know a guy's going to react, I'm going to hit opposite. He won't force and pull the ball out of the offense and try to do too much. Within the flow of stuff, he actually could be better when he has some more creation from the point guard position. Defensively, it wasn't great last night. I'm not as concerned on that end as I think you are.
Yeah, maybe not.
Russell Westbrook, channel it.
It's positive yeah. Mindset.
Yes.
France. Let's go to Arkansas Baylor. Moses Moody had a rough NCAA tournament.
Yes.
Did not go as well as what we were hoping, especially given the way he finished the season. Like, he was really good for Arkansas in those last, what, I would say 4, 5, 6 games. Like, he went 24 points against Alabama, 18 against LSU, 28 against South Carolina, 28 against Texas A&M. He had 5 against Missouri, and then 28 in that great SEC tournament game against LSU again. It just didn't really look all that efficient in the way that he was getting his baskets. He struggled to get to super efficient looks, it felt like, in the NCAA tournament. Even like against Oral Roberts, who is not like a wildly high-end defense, like it seemed like he was just struggling to... He got to the spot, missed the shot in some cases, but then also like got to the spot, or like didn't even get to the spot at times to beat his defender there and get what could be considered a clean look, and still took like a somewhat difficult look. You know what I mean?
Sure. And Arkansas is taking it really well. They're blowing up social media saying he ran and hid during the tournament, and so much so that former Razorback Bobby Portis actually went to his defense saying he's going to be good. He's similar to the Russell Westbrook thing. He's going to be able to take care of his family and still make money off of this. 4 for 20 versus Oral Roberts, despite the 14 points. He's 2 for 10 in that loss against Baylor. Combined 0 for 7 from 3 in those two games. He's 3 for 17 overall. He had a bad first half in that Baylor game, and a sideline reporter asked Coach Musselman at half what he had to do to get him going, and he said Moody has to get himself going, which there's definitely some truth to that. Maybe he could have got like Corey Kispert had a bad first half last game, and the first play out of halftime, Mark Few runs just like a little pin down, a curl. I think he missed the shot, but for shooters, you just need to get that comfort basket, get to the free throw line, and start feeling better. Moody never hit that rhythm. I am worried. I had a friend ask me about, we've talked at length about Chris Duarte and how well he's playing, he's surging. Chris Duarte is still like 4-ish years older than Moses Moody. Do we get on board with saying in 4 years, the development, I'm not saying he could be Duarte, but like, how does that look, and how do we even balance that with that age discrepancy there?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it ultimately comes down to, like, do we think Moses Moody has star potential versus do we think that, like, because right now Chris Duarte is a better player than Moses Moody. Like, we can say that pretty comfortably.
Yes, right? And I say because they're going to be bunched in this wing shootery type group, that those will kind of be the head-to-head comps that NBA teams are at least having some preliminary conversations about.
So, like, would you rather have Chris Duarte... Like, Chris Duarte's second contract, is going to be when he's like 28 years old. And like his second contract's going to end when he's like 32.
But isn't that okay though? If you're a contender, don't you want somebody just like right now? And it's not even a development 4 or 5 years from now.
I mean, the big question is how close do you think Duarte is to his ceiling versus how close do you think Moody is to his ceiling? Right. And what is the difference between them now? Right. Like there is a difference. Like Chris Duarte is a better player right now. I would say somewhat comfortably, not very comfortably, but like there's a real difference there, right? Because Duarte is a like genuine disruptive defender. He's a better shooter right now. He's more comfortable, more poised on the bounce, like just a little bit better overall player. The question is, does Moody have, especially given his frame, right? Like he's a ridiculous frame, like 6'6", 7-foot wingspan, 205 pounds. Does he have something in there that he can get to? Because he has like he has some of that like real creativity shit off the bounce too. Like he knows how to get to the foul line. Like he averaged 6 free throws a game. He's really good at flailing his arms out and like drawing contact on like rakes across the arms, right? And he's still 18. Like he's one of the youngest freshmen in this class. I would think Moses Moody is going to get better. Like I understand he had a bad 4 games. I understand that he had a bad 4 games in the worst possible time.
Yeah, not great. Yeah.
I'm still pretty comfortable taking that dude in the lottery. Like I think people are going to be surprised that like I'm not really wavering from where I am on Moody. Did not have a great 4 games, but this is a kid who's 18 years old, comfortably won the SEC Freshman of the Year over guys, by the way, that like because their teams did not go as far in the NCAA tournament are now like getting passes. Like Keon Johnson and Jaden Springer were terrible against Oregon State.
Correct. Like, yeah.
Awful. And because they weren't bad for 4 games, they were only bad for 1 game in a game where their team got eliminated, we're like giving them the benefit of the doubt, it feels like almost. Like, isn't that kind of how it feels?
Yeah, a little bit. But I like
Moses Moody was better than them the entire year.
During the year, yes. But now it's the biggest stage, the brightest lights. And when you lose in the first round, you kind of become an afterthought and forgotten because so much is going on. And now when you're really zoned in and, okay, we're at the Elite Eight, we're at the Sweet 16, the microscope gets bigger. And the battle for 6th, and I'm excited to see your big board dropped, and I'm just going to use your mock draft 3.0 rankings for here. We joke about it, just to kind of give it some context. You had Scotty Barnes 6th. He had single-digit points every tournament game, 11 turnovers to 9 assists, 2 games he took 2 field goal attempts. 7, Keon Johnson. They lose to Oregon State by 14 in the first round, which now doesn't look like a bad loss because Oregon State's apparently awesome. But he goes 6 for 16, a lot of points once the game was decided. 8, we have Moses Moody. We talked about his shooting woes. 9, James Bouknight, very hard time against Maryland zone and Daryl Morsell. 10, Kai Jones, 11 points and a loss to Abilene Christian. There hasn't,
by the way,
been
was the only good player in that game for Texas, probably.
Right. So there hasn't been separation. And then you have Chris Duarte at 21 points on 16 shots. Davion Mitchell is awesome. And we're talking about those guys, where can they fit in the 20 and in 20 range? And 6 for 10, we're just kind of shrugging and saying, like, yeah, they haven't done it, but maybe it's a hand wave. Maybe they're good enough. Are teams able and willing and patient enough to invest in probably higher ceiling guys that we just rattled off here? Or do you want more of a probably finished product in Chris Duarte and Davion Mitchell? And that's not a bad thing either.
I think that people are wildly underestimating how hard it is to be good in the NCAA tournament at 18 years old and 19 years old. Like, Davion Mitchell, Chris Duarte, Jalen Suggs is just fucking awesome. Like,
yes.
You know, so, and by the way, Jalen Suggs, like you said, like, has not really gone off in the NCAA tournament before that game against USC.
Yes.
Like, we're underestimating how fucking difficult it is to be that good on the biggest stage, in the way that like everyone anticipates for these guys who are 19 years old and still trying to figure out in many cases what their games were. Like, by the way, Cam Thomas, he had like what, 28 points in each of their first 2 games or whatever it was. Yes. Like, Cam Thomas didn't really impact winning in those games, though. Like, Cam Thomas just did the Cam Thomas show, right?
Yes.
But, so, like...
but actually, my hesitation there, too, is you want guys to figure out on the big stage. It can't be it can be like a half hand wave, but can't be a complete hand wave. And it's just harder when Moody goes back-to-back 4 for 20 and 2 for 10. If you have the 4 for 20, then you bounce back and you have 24 points. And, hey, the shooting's not falling, but you're 13 for 15 for the free throw line, which you did a few times. You're getting out in transition. But to not have that in either of those kind of elite-ish matchups, it's going to hurt your draft stock a little bit.
Yeah, I get that. I do. But, like, just look at the guys who've had success in this tournament. Like, there's a reason that it's mostly older guys. Like, what, Drew Timmy is, what, 20, I think, right? Like, he's not, like, a super young sophomore, right? Corey Kispert's 22. Davion Mitchell, I think, is 21 or 22. You know, Houston's guys, like, Quentin Grimes has been around. Like, he's 21, 22. Dejon Giroux is 21,
yeah,
22.
Yeah, transferred, yep.
Johnny Juzang just turned 20, so, like, maybe, you know, we can make a case that Johnny Juzang is kind of the exception here. Jaime Jaquez just turned 20. But again, these guys are 20, and they've had a year of experience in college basketball where these guys haven't yet. I think it's really hard to just be like, oh, they sucked in the tournament. We need to throw away what we've seen from them this year. You know what I mean?
No, it's not a throwaway. You can't do that because all we do is rally against recency bias. The more of spotlight that is there in the NCAA tournament, you look at it more, you analyze it more, and some of those weaknesses stand out where you want Franz Wagner to shoot the ball better. It doesn't have to be the game winner, that's fine, but one for 10 isn't awesome.
But, like, the other thing
is,
too,
that's just a criticism.
That, like, people are real excited about Max Asemus right now. Like, you and I have talked about Max Asemus on the podcast probably 4 or 5 times this year before the tournament, right? Something like that?
Yeah, at least a couple. Yeah, we are so far back in Max Asemus, we didn't even pronounce his name right. That's how long we've been at this party. We thought it was Abrams, but yeah.
Yeah, we thought it was Abmus. Yeah.
Abmus, yeah.
but we've been to this show. So, like, we know what the weaknesses are with Max. And, like, we know that he has no chance to defend right now and that he needs to really improve there. And we know that he needs to improve as a decision maker, which is why I think that you and I have not been as overreactive to things, right? Like, we haven't quite been as willing to just throw shit, like, over the boat. You know what I mean? Whenever.
No, and for, which I thought was fortuitous a little bit, this week, a lot of the media, yourself included, circled back to that Carson Edwards run from a few years ago. And that Virginia game, and he had 42 points on 14 and 25 shooting. That was one of the crazier scoring runs that I can remember, where he had 26 against Old Dominion, 42 against Villanova, 29 against Tennessee, 42 versus Virginia. We look back now, we see this, and Carson Edwards, who was drafted 33rd overall, who's bouncier, who's bigger than Asemus, probably a better athlete, he plays 10 minutes per game in the NBA. Not a slight at him. But how can we then slide in Max Asemus, who has a similar type of run that's smaller, can't defend as well, maybe the shot's a little bit better, can hit some crazier stuff, but we also can't jump to that conclusion either.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Like, totally, totally agree. Let's just kind of rapid fire through some of these guys, because some of these other guys we've talked about quite a bit on the podcast recently. Quentin Grimes, we've mentioned a few times, he just continues to be really good. Like, I'm at the point where I think I would take Quentin Grimes in the second round, like, pretty comfortably. What do you think?
Yeah, not a shot creator, but at 6'5", he is a threat from three. He's been, like, 4 for 8, 5 for 9, 4 for 12, 4 for 10 from three. He's shot a lot more threes this season, too. He's 99 for 240, which is not this small sample of 78 threes, which we're wondering if he can shoot or not. He's doubled his attempts from last year. And moves the ball well, crisp passes, hit the middle of the zone a little bit, hit the short corner, look for cutters. I'm more in on him than I was a couple months ago, I guess. And the success helps. Like, we can't deny that.
Yep, still only 20 years old, like, very clearly. And by the way, like, not a guy, again, that has been just like a pop-up guy either. All-American this year, like, very clearly a draft-worthy player, in my opinion, and someone who should probably leave at the end of the year. We haven't talked a ton about Dejan Giroux. I think it ultimately comes down to what you think of the shot. I mean, like, look, like, you went to UMass. I'm sure you have a better feel for Giroux than I do.
Yeah, it's look, it's a sore subject when you have a UMass transfer who's telling people after a tournament game he's a savage and carried the team on his back and makes these energy and defensive plays. The shot is the swing set. He can hit those floaters. He can beat guys off the dribble. Can he shoot it? I don't really know that answer.
Yeah. The big question is the shot. He's gotten way better defensively, obviously still a really good passer. I worry a little bit about the shot too, or the like decision making too. Just, you know, being able to not be so wild all the time. But
yes, and he has reeled it in. And
he's totally
bought in. That whole team has bought into that culture that they've instilled there as a coaching staff. So he's been where UMass, it was the expectation that he would be a franchise type guy. He's one of their better players, but he doesn't have to have such a heavy offensive lift.
Okay. The Baylor guys, I mean, Davion Mitchell's just unbelievable. I'm writing a little bit about Davion Mitchell in the big board post that you have coming tomorrow and the next day. Just a stud. Jared Butler has not been awesome. I mean, where are we at on those two?
Davion Mitchell is surging crazy. He's showed everything. His vision on pick and roll continues to really impress me. He slows the game down, then he steps on the gas and has that little left-handed scoop pass to dunkers. He beats his man, too. When he's a little bit smaller, has a bigger defender. He can release it at funny, like, unorthodox release timing and points, so he's not blocked. He made the first jumper against Arkansas. He did, like, the slow clap, and they zoomed in on the glare, and you knew it was kind of over. And a guy who's nicknamed Off Night because he makes the best offensive player have an off night, I want to draft him. Yeah. Jared Butler, similar concerns, had a hard time against bigger physical guys like Brandon Slater from Villanova, who's 6'6". Same thing against Houston. Any switch onto a big became a jump shot and sometimes off balance. He's better when he has a dribble to operate and didn't pull from three in those scenarios. Just want him to turn the switch a little bit earlier. I had Butler ahead of Mitchell early in the year, and those guys to me have certainly flip-flopped.
Yeah, no, I have Mitchell. I think Mitchell's like very clearly their best player. I understand that, like, you know, some people might take that as reactive, but I mean, just watch their games, man.
No, it's been a build, though. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like the numbers say it. The tape says it. Like Jared Butler, I know Jared Butler like made the Big 12 all defense team. Like that was a weird one, didn't you think?
He's a final 15 for the national award too with Davion and Mark Vidal. Yeah.
Yeah, like the level to which Vidal and Mitchell are more important than him defensively is staggering. I'm Butler's a fine defender, but like I don't think he's anywhere near that. Like Jericho Sims missing the all Big 12 defense team to put a third Baylor guy and Jared Butler on there was bizarre to me. But yeah, like I think Davion Mitchell is very clearly their best all around player. He's the guy that like stirs the drink for this team.
Yes.
Butler's definitely a great scorer, a great passer as well. I think that is a bit underrated with him, but yeah. Matthew Meyer just continues to do Matthew Meyer-y things. Everyone gets real excited for one game, and then he has like 17 against Wisconsin, and people are pumped. And then you look back at his last, it's like 7 or 8 games. He's had 3 points, 3 points, 5 points, 8 points, 6 points, 7 points. With Wisconsin for 17 in the middle of that, like we need to just tap the brakes on Matthew Meyer.
Tap the brakes, just a slight tap. But he comes in, he gives you a different look. I forget what game it was, but he came off the bench. He hit a three, ended up being a timeout. Those guys too, their depth is ridiculous. And as a wider angle thing too, it amazes me how unselfish those guards are. I mean, they don't seem to care who gets the credit and yep. Meyer when he's on the floor too. The balls move, they make the extra pass. His numbers are lower probably because of that. And he can force the action at times, done a better job of reeling it back in and playing within what they're trying to do.
Totally. Do you want to have one final thing on Chris Duarte and Eugene Omoruye?
Yeah, one last thing. Chris Duarte is awesome. We've said that. I think we dipped our toes earlier. We're diving all the way in the deep end now. He shoots, defends, doesn't over dribble. He's efficient. He had that comeback a little bit against USC, and you know what you're getting. He's older, but his attributes and his strengths outweigh the age shaming that some people do and the other weaknesses. He can plug and play. I'm a believer in him still now more than ever.
Okay. We wanted to talk a little bit about the Indiana hire. Do you feel like people are overreacting to like saying this is a bad hire at Indiana?
Yes, because we don't know. We talked about Mick Cronin and people were saying, I don't know, that might not work. It worked. He's in the Final Four. People overreacted a little bit, not as crazy with the Juwan Howard thing when he was hired at Michigan, not a thing at all. And they've had success at Michigan, and you're wondering how much of that has impacted, influenced other schools wanting to create that same recipe. And with the Mike Woodson hire, they also added Thad Matta in a non-coaching role, who's been in that league, recruiting that league, knows what it takes, similar to what Juwan did with Phil Martelli as an assistant, who's a longtime head coach at St. Joe's. Michigan had a great staff. I think it came out today that Indiana's retaining Kenya Hunter, so they're putting some pieces together. I after what we've seen and the way things shake out, I don't want to rush to judgment right away. Like, we got to give it a season or two, and maybe this is the new wave of NBA guys. There's other guys mentioned for jobs that are open, but we got to wait to judge here.
Well, and here's the other thing about Mike Woodson. Like, yeah, Mike Woodson was probably not like a top 10 coach in the NBA, right? That's fine. The NBA is like where the finest minds are in basketball. Like, it's cool that he was not a top 10 mind in the NBA. Having said that, his record in the NBA is way better than what people say. Like, they throw out like the losing career mark. Look at the context. Like, when he took that Atlanta job, do you know who the best players were on the Atlanta Hawks?
I know you do. I don't off the top of my head.
So it was Ty Lue was their starting point guard. Like,
okay. Many moons ago, yes.
Yeah. It was Josh Smith's like rookie season. It was Josh Childress's like second season, something like that. They had Al Harrington and they had like older Antoine Walker, I think. Like, it was just like, what are we doing here? You know what I mean?
Sounds like a good lineup to me, or at least for the content. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course they won like 18 games that year or whatever they won. But from every year that Mike Woodson had the Hawks job, that team won an increasing number of games every season. Like, they got better every single year. They built every single year to where they got better. And then he leaves and goes and gets the Knicks job. And in his first full season, because he took that Knicks job midway through a season, in his first full season as the Knicks coach, they win 50 games. And if I remember correctly, is that the year Carmelo made the second round, I want to say? I think they made the second round.
I'm saying yes. I don't know the answer.
Like, he was a good NBA coach. Like, imagine winning freaking like that many games in the NBA with the Knicks when James Dolan's your owner. What are we doing here?
I'm not worried about the coaching part of it. I'm really not. I don't know his style, coaching, recruiting. It's staff and who you connect with, which is the difference. And with Juwan Howard, he gets it because he played at a high level in college, played in the NBA, coached the NBA, has a son on the team at Michigan, has a son who plays at IMG Academy, who's very good too. He knows that lifestyle. I just get worried about NBA guys coming when it's not always going to be upscale stuff and great hotels. It's different when you're recruiting high school kids and outskirts suburban gyms and hoping when you get out of the 940 set that there's a gas station open for a bite to eat. It's just different. Like, you have to be able to pull guys in, and Juwan Howard's like adjustment has been so seamless. I don't want to say he makes it look easy, because he clearly works hard and has done an unbelievable job there. He's recruiting at a high level where they were good this year. Clearly they just lost in the Elite Eight, and they have a six-man class headline next year by draft prospects in Caleb Houston and Musa Diabate. He's got it. Like, if Mike Woodson's able to replicate that from the coaching, and he's able to do what he's done in the NBA plus go and get guys, they'll be fine. But it's always just who you're able to hire and connect in that area, in that region, to pull in good enough players to compete.
And yeah, like, I just kind of think that he'll be fine doing that. Like, here's the thing that I think is being underestimated by this. First and foremost, I don't think people care about going, okay, let me change that tone, because that will get me in trouble.
Edit here, cut. Yeah.
Less and less. I think that NBA, I think high school prospects care about, like, going to college to, like, be involved in the pageantry of college basketball. More and more, the 4- and 5-star prospects that have, like, a very high level chance of making the NBA care about making the NBA. And people can, like, laugh off and say, like, oh, well, Mike Woodson has no name recognition compared to Juwan Howard. That's true, but he's going to be able to sit into living rooms and say, like, I've coached this, this, and this guy. Here's how I developed them. Here's how I went about things. That's probably going to be a pretty effective pitch, I think. Like, it's not just being like, oh my God, like, he's not Juwan Howard. He doesn't have that name recognition. I mean, like, it's fucking Indiana. He's going to get in the door regardless.
Right.
And then you
coach for Indiana. You're in. Yeah.
Right. And then, like, once he gets in the door, it's all about how insightful he can be. And I think that that pitch is actually pretty good whenever it comes to that. Like, look, I'm not saying he's going to be, like, a successful coach or anything either. Like, I don't know. I think there is a chance that it doesn't work quite as well as what we want it to. But I think there's a pretty good chance it works. Like, we're throwing out there too these guys like Terry Porter and Mark Price and
Clyde Drexler, Dan Marley. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they went to worse situations than this too. Sure.
Yes.
Like, as long as, like, I do think Mike Woodson needs to hire the right staff for sure. But I think that about every high major job at the end of the day now. And I kind of think that this is going to be fine. Like, I don't think it's any different than Indiana going out and hiring. Like, look, if they could go out and hire Scott Drew or Chris Beard or some shit, like, yeah, go do that. But, like, I think this is, like, right in the same ballpark as going to hire Porter Moser or going to hire, you know, Paul Mills or whoever the fuck else you're going to hire that has a college basketball experience and is riding high right now as, like, an incredible college coaching candidate, right?
Different than Moser because the success he's had at a non-traditional power at times has turned them into a top 10 Ken Pom team every year. It has made him to a Final Four. I like the connective piece that you brought up because Micah Shrewsbury was also just hired at Penn State, and his pitch is, I helped develop Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. That's pretty powerful if you're in a living room and you're a wing and you're 6'7" and you want to play in the NBA. When Mike Woodson got the job, Trace Jackson Davis, who's Indiana's best player and deciding, debating, I don't think he's declared for the draft, but it seems like everyone's declared for the draft actually today. He tweeted out like the eyeball emoji. Don't have to read too far into it, but clearly it's piqued his interest. He's, I'm guessing, going to hear it out. And if you're talking to an NBA coach who has been in the NBA for years and that's your ultimate goal, he's probably going to help develop, get you to that spot, or at least put you in a position to be spotlighted that you're going to look good enough to be on the right radars for what you're doing. Maybe Trace Jackson Davis is now shooting more out of pick and pop stuff into an isolation because yep. Coach Woodson knows that's the NBA game. And it's not necessarily throwing the post, what Coach Miller did. And that's not a bad thing either. He tried to play a different way. Maybe some more NBA style with sets. So we just have to wait. We have to slow down with everything and stop rushing before we see some results.
So, like, here's the other part of this too. And I don't mean to disparage college coaches here, but what is being run in the NBA currently offensively is pretty substantially more impressive and intricate than what is being run from an offensive perspective in college basketball as a whole. There are great college basketball offensive coaches. Like Jay Wright is fucking exceptional as an offensive coach. Mark Few is exceptional. You know, we can go up and down the list. Like, I think Fran McCaffrey actually does, like, a really good job on offense. I think Chris Holtman does a really good job on offense. But by and large, like, running spread pick and roll, I mean, we just saw what could happen with it if you get the right players in the right situations. Like, Max Asemus just, like, rolled to the Sweet 16 with Kevin O'Banner and, like, three other guys.
Literally rolled, yes.
Like, I think there is a distinct advantage to having someone who would be willing to do that at the college level right now. Like, I think that offensive spread floor teams who can also switch defensively and like bring some NBA concepts down to college is a marginal inefficiency right now within college basketball. And if I don't know if Mike Woodson's going to do that, like maybe he just goes full college basketball from his time at Indiana and runs like what fucking Bob Knight ran. Like
he's running the flex. Yeah.
Yeah. Like maybe he will do that, but that would be a departure from his NBA teams and what he's run at that level. So I don't know. Like I'm not as I was high on the Juwan Howard hire. I thought it was smart. Like you talk to people about Juwan Howard in the NBA and they're like, this guy's fucking awesome. He's going to be a great coach. Most of them thought he'd be a great head coach in the NBA. He's now a great coach in college. Like that's great. I think there's a good chance Mike Woodson's pretty good. There's a chance it falls apart because we don't know necessarily what it looks like, but I think there's a good chance that he's pretty good.
Indiana, too, if you want to kind of keep in the family, there's not a ton of names there as well. And it does have some cachet, and you hope that he can take the best parts of Indiana basketball and go beyond the Bob Knight era success and feed that fan base. It wasn't a name initially that was when Archie Miller was bought out for whatever it was, $10+ million. There's always this rapid reaction, and like his name wasn't necessarily one that you said, okay, you bought him out, like Mike Woodson's the guy. Part of it will be settling in for people to understand that this is now your head coach. You better get used to it.
Right. Okay, the last things that we want to talk about, movies. Have you seen any movies recently, Matt Penn?
Shockingly, yes, because I have been jacked up post games like the next 2 or 3 days in between, so I watched... What did I watch? I watched Operation Varsity Blues about the admission scandal.
I have not watched that yet. How was it?
Okay. It was good. It was interesting. I knew enough about the story, but what they did was they recreated like the wiretap transcripts with actors. So you kind of had to like be in that world and then also had the real life explanations from the people involved, and they kind of paired it together. It was good. It was entertaining. Probably it was like an hour and a half, could have been half hour shorter because he kept on beating on the same thing, but entertaining.
Sure. Okay. I watched Seaspiracy.
I saw that. I clicked by that because I watched that and I watched the last Blockbuster, but I saw Seaspiracy. That does seem like a Sam pick, a Sam's choice on the Blockbuster rack.
It was a Laura pick. It was not a me pick.
You're already distancing yourself.
So, really important information. Like all about the fishing industry and how much damage it does to the oceans. Holy fuck, it was the worst documentary I think I've ever seen from a filmmaking perspective in my life. This guy who made this documentary, he needs you to know that he did multiple on-camera interviews with security experts telling him that what he was doing to get this information was life-threatening. Like, he literally...
Put the camera away. I saw that when scrolling through. You know, when you're, like, you're over the title, and it does, like, a 10-second clip. Four times that you're going to die if you take this film. Put it away.
Right. And, like, he has to pop that into the thing. Like, this... Yes, if you don't take the right precautions, like, this could be life-threatening. Like, what are you doing? Like, and it looked so, like... fucking drawn out, and like it was staged, and like this dude was like acting. It was fucking terrible. Like really important information. Like, please, people, Google more information about how the fishing industry causes problems for the sea with pollution and with the way that essentially we consume food that comes from the sea, but aka seafood. But yeah, that documentary was holy shit bad. Impressively bad. I'm trying to think if I watched anything else. I don't think I have, really.
Did you watch the last Blockbuster yet?
I haven't. Is it good?
I enjoyed it. Same thing. It probably could have been like an hour special about the last Blockbuster video in Bend, Oregon. Some of the things they hit on really hit close to home. And when you walked into a Blockbuster video, just like the kind of smell of it, and you could physically hold the movie you want to get, and you go to the new releases, and if it's not there, you go to the front desk and ask if anyone's returned it. It was a little bit of a nostalgia trip, and people have turned it into that by still going to that last existing brick-and-mortar one in our our digital Netflixy world.
All right. So the last segment here is the one where we're introducing it for the first time. So you, I, and a friend of ours who, I don't know, at some point we'll have him pop on the podcast because he's now like kind of allowed to do so.
Transitioning. Yeah.
For reasons that we'll talk about at some point. We have a group text and we were just like throwing out recruiting stories because for people who don't know, like, Penny's main job, like how he makes most of the money, it's not the sweet, sweet podcasting money. It's that he's an event organizer on the AAU circuit. Particularly does a lot of work with Under Armour, right?
Yes, that's fair.
So Matt has a lot of great recruiting stories. And we're going to, at the end of every podcast, just do recruiting story corner with Matt Penny because
you're painting I'm hard in the corner, but I'm start punching back because I gotta keep it above board too, but yeah, keep going.
Right So one of the stories he's telling us, and it's funny, like our other friend is like Matt's friend more than he's my friend really, but like we're all like close now. So he knew this story and was just like started to tell me, or just they just like started talking in code really, and I was like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? And then Penny told this story. So Penny, please,
you're building it up like it's a great story. It's a yuck, but it's not a multiple.
Yeah,
yuck.
It's funny.
Yeah, it's quick. So in 2011, I started as an intern at Reebok, and at the same time, they're relaunching their All-American Basketball Camp, which was renamed the Reebok Breakout Challenge. Reebok had signed John Wall in 2010 after being the number one pick in the draft. And John's backstory with Reebok is he drove to an All-American tryout in Chicago, earned an invitation to All-American camp in Philadelphia, goes later in the summer, has a huge week, becomes the number one player in the country. Rest is history. So in 2011, they relaunched this breakout camp with John as the face of it. Following that camp, Reebok has this summit for 8 high school players at their headquarters. And John is there helping, putting kids through drills. Really hands-on, really good. I don't know what was lost in translation, but everyone calls me Penny. Someone shortened it to Pen, like, hey, Pen, can you go get me a pair of sneakers or whatever? I said, sure. So John must have misheard it and just stored it in his memory. So he misheard it, and he thought my name was Ben. And as an intern, you don't want to correct, like, the number one pick in the draft. You speak when spoken to. But John's a very outgoing person. He'll communicate with everybody. So going forward, in the gym every morning, he'd yell across the gym, what up, Ben? And I would just return with, what up, John? I rolled with it. And that day, I just became Ben for a summer because I didn't want to tell John Wall, who's this franchise guy at Reebok and for an NBA team, that, like, yeah, dude, my name's actually Penny. And it was the time also when the Reebok Zig was created, which will never go away because that's the ultimate, like, referee shoe that won't die. And he also told me that he invented the Zig, said I invented these. And okay, John, thanks, Ben. So that this is just like a little peek into the craziness and the stuff you deal with over a summer with guys.
How long has he thought your name is Ben?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't talked to him since, but seeing him again, like during that period there for a couple months, thought I was Ben, and everyone got a good kick out of it, and it had a little bit of legs. But luckily, I've become Penny again, which is nice.
That might be the new intro to the podcast. I'm just going to go, what up, Ben?
My friend, Ben. Yeah. You know what the funny thing about names is? That he used to be called Jimmy, so he had a t-shirt say Jimmy on it, and his name was John. So maybe it was just playing into that theme of it.
Oh, my God. Penny, tell the people where they can find what you've got going on.
Oh, man. I'm at Twitter, Matt_Penny. Let's ride this NCAA tournament to its conclusion. A lot of draft stuff, obviously, upcoming. Trying to have some videos when the guys declare. Zaire Williams was today, James Book night. I'm sure we have more in the coming days and weeks.
All right. So Penny has 1162 Twitter followers now. We need to spike that, guys. Come on. Let's get real.
Very good. It's a good spike. It's about interactions and engagement.
True. That's great. You have a good group right now.
Good group. Great people. Yeah.
Please go subscribe to The Athletic. I have written 17 stories this month. And then on top of it, I have another one coming either tomorrow or the next day. Breaking down my top 100 and some performances in the NCAA tournament thus far. So keep it locked there. You literally cannot get more content than what I am giving you right now on The Athletic. My brain is like just genuinely breaking every single day. So please go subscribe to The Athletic. Follow me at Sam_Vecini if you don't already. But until next time, we'll talk soon. And that will be, I think, at some point later this week/weekend. So until next time, bye.